be upon him. And there are recommendations towards us, the Shia of Ahlul Bayt, the followers of Ahlul Bayt, that whenever we drink water, we do remember the thirst of Imam Hussein, Salamullahi Alayh.
Ayatollah Javadi Amiri, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Now let me conclude with some of the issues that are extremely important for us to remember when it does come to appreciating our food and our drinking. When we're talking about the table spread, the ma'ida, the sufra, and the sunnahs, the etiquette, the mannerism that needs to be observed in that kind of environment, when you're sitting down eating by yourself or eating with other people, when you're looking at the food, to be thankful to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, appreciate what it is that you have, and always remember that the worst thing is for you to be extravagant. The worst thing is for you to waste. That's why one of the sunnahs of Islam is what Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi mentions, where he says, "Man tatabba'a ma yasqutu min as-sufrati ghufira lah." If someone picks up that which has fell down onto the sufra, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will forgive your sins. There is another hadith that says each little piece of rice that is left on your plate is equal to the reciting of the surah, for example. We also know that when you are at home, you should make sure that nothing is going to waste. You pick up every single piece of food and be thankful to God and eat it. Try not to waste and throw things away, remembering that wasting is haram. But if you are in the outside, if you are in nature, if you are in a park or something like that, then it is recommended for you to leave that which has fell out of your plate, because animals and birds will come and eat from it. Imam Al-Jawad, Salamullahi Alayh, he says, مَا كَانَ فِي الصَّحْرَاءِ فَدَعَهُ. That which has fell down from you while you are eating in the, for example, the plains, in the desert, then leave it. But if it's something that falls down from you, from your plate, for example, while you're at home, then pick it up and eat it. We will continue on in our next episode. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahireen.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams. Hear the children's cries.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty windowpane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhis salam. Please stay with me. Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon him, summoned Muslims to weep out of fear of Allah. Weeping is among the signs of faith. It shows the relationship between the servant and his Lord and Creator.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. Now you're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find in the historical texts of the Muslims a whole host of beautiful conversations and dialogues. In these conversations and these dialogues, of course, we find very beautiful pieces of advice, wisdom, and knowledge which can lead to a human being's personal and spiritual perfection. In one of these instances, we find that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam has a conversation with one of his loyal companions, his very faithful followers, and his student by the name of Muhammad bin Muslim. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, in this conversation with Muhammad bin Muslim, says, "Consider not as small the good deed you do, for you will see it where it pleases you. Consider not as small the evil deed you do, for you will see it where it displeases you. Do good to people, for the good deed erases the past sins." Dear friends, in this beautiful conversation between Muhammad bin Muslim and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, we find that in these very short sentences, Imam al-Baqir gives such profound wisdom and knowledge. First, he says, "Never consider a good deed to be too small, too insignificant," meaning you should always do a good deed, whether it is large or whether it is small. And he says, because this small deed, you will see it being rewarded on the day of judgment, on the day where that small, insignificant good deed will bring you great rewards. And likewise, consider not small the evil deed that you do, for even a small evil wrong is a wrong indeed. And Imam al-Baqir says, you will see this bad deed, this forbidden act, where it displeases you, meaning on the Day of Judgment, when even a small act of disobedience has the potential to be punished severely. And finally, Imam al-Baqir says, do good to people, for a good deed erases the past sins. Very beautiful pieces of advice in this interesting and intimate conversation between Muhammad bin Muslim and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
When we remember our fifth imam, we remember an important part of the recommendations of the fifth imam, which I would like to narrate for you in this regard, which he gave to his famous companion, Jabir Ju'fi. He told him, the fifth imam, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi, to him, I'm going to give you tips, Imam al-Baqir says, things, remember them. Imam alayhi salam says, فَمَنْ لَذِي يَغُرُّكَ مِنْ نَفْسِكَ. Why do you think you're so great? Why I chose this part? Because unfortunately, some of our youth and some of our brothers and sisters out there, they think they know. They think that they have already clocked it. They are 20, 21. It's not about the age, yes? I'm not saying necessarily just because they are young, they're not. But it's because when they are given advice by ulama, when they are given advice by the people, what do? They ignore it. You don't know. You haven't lived our times. I have to do this. I have to do that. Yes. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, when people give you advice, when people are speaking to you, present it as far as the Quran is concerned. If you don't know how to do that, then seek the people who have knowledge regarding this. And what does the Quran say with regards to adab of, for example, dialogue and debate? How I should debate? How I should come across? And this is an important message and a reminder, a brotherly advice for all the brothers and sisters who are thinking to do whatever they wish out there, to go on YouTube and to make and to say whatever they want to in the name of tashayyu, in the name of Islam. It is not a joke. Yes, we have all these pseudo alims out there, people who even have an imam of their head here in London, one of them, yes, comes out, says he's a sheikh and whatever, and speaks against the maraji, speaks against the Shia, speaks against respected individuals who are honored by our brothers Ahlul Sunnah in such a public, vile manner. Yes, this is unacceptable. This is not part of the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi wasalam, and of course before that, the Holy Quran.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
in the limelight.
Studies have shown that climate change is supercharging some weather and climate events and will lead to more severe and longer-lasting heat waves, stronger hurricanes, an increased wildfire risk, and a longer wildfire season. American people can also expect more heavy rain events and severe droughts, not to mention other extreme events like February's polar vortex. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Tara Lohan under the heading, Climate-driven extreme weather is imperiling wildlife conservation efforts in U.S. The article has been taken from the truthout.org website. Please stay with us for more of Tara Lohan's article. Hailstorm in southern Texas, tornadoes in Tennessee, wildfires across the western United States, a barrage of Gulf Coast hurricanes. Those are among the record 22 weather and climate disasters that each topped $1 billion in damages last year in the United States. In all, the price tag for 2020 hit a whopping $95 billion, and that's just in the United States. Reinsurance firm Swiss Re put global economic losses at $175 billion last year, including $32 billion for floods in China and $13 billion in damages from Cyclone Amphan across India and Bangladesh. The worst news? Americans' profligate burning of fossil fuels means they're in store for more of this. Studies show that climate change is supercharging some weather and climate events and will lead to more severe and longer-lasting heat waves, stronger hurricanes, an increased wildlife risk, and a longer wildfire season. American people can also expect more heavy rain events and more severe droughts, not to mention other extreme events like last February's polar vortex. Bruce Stein, chief scientist and associate vice president at the National Wildlife Federation, says, "You can't attribute any particular storm to climate change, but what we do know is that climate change tips the odds of making many of these events more severe. While experts tabulate the economic losses, homes destroyed, crops ruined, businesses shuttered, the ecosystems and wildlife can also sustain damage that's harder to quantify." Bruce Stein says many plants and wildlife evolved with and have adapted to dealing with large-scale disturbances, but we're beginning to see mega-disturbances at levels beyond what we saw in the past. And that can take a toll. Extreme weather can kill animals directly or indirectly, like by destroying food sources, contaminating water, or altering habitat, forcing a species to move into areas where there may be more competition, fewer resources, or a greater risk of predation. The effects of climate change on the natural world are being felt at two speeds. One is more gradual, referred to by scientists as ramping, shrinking glaciers, rising sea levels. The second is quick, like extreme weather events. Sean Maxwell, a postdoctoral research fellow at University of Queensland Centre for Biodiversity and Conservation Science, says both are problematic. But he adds, "I think the changes to acute events have the greatest potential to devastate local populations or ecosystems, and the impacts of these events are often more difficult to plan for or to avoid. Sean Maxwell was the lead author of a 2018 study published in the journal Diversity and Distributions that examined how changes in the frequency and intensity of extreme weather and climate events affected wildlife. The researchers looked at 519 studies of ecological responses to extreme events, including cyclones, droughts, floods, and heat waves and cold waves, that took place from 1941 to 2015. They found that the response was negative 57% of the time, and in those instances where species benefited, they were mostly invasive species. Sean Maxwell says some of the negative responses we found were quite concerning, including more than 100 cases of dramatic population declines and 31 cases of local population extinction following an extreme event, adding, populations of critically endangered bird species in Hawaii, such as the palia, have been annihilated due to drought, and populations of lizard species have been wiped out due to cyclones in the Bahamas. The researchers found plant species had the highest number of negative responses to extreme events, followed by reptiles and amphibians. The researchers concluded, collectively, the studies in our review suggest that extreme weather and climate events have profound implications for species and ecosystem management. Species that are already threatened or endangered are, of course, specially at risk. Take the Atwater prairie chicken, for example. A million of these birds once ranged across the prairies of Texas and Louisiana. Today, fewer than 100 remain in the wild, and scientists have sought to bolster their populations with captive breeding programs. But when Hurricane Harvey walloped Texas with 130-mile-per-hour winds and record rainfall in 2017, the birds were right in harm's way. Other species with limited ranges, like those on islands, also face big threats. In 2017, Hurricane Maria cut the population of just 200 Puerto Rican parrots in half. The year before, Hurricane Matthew was believed to have wiped out the last Bahama nuthatches, or Sitta insularis. According to Diana Bell, a professor of conservation biology at the University of East Anglia in Britain, it took 2 years before a few of the birds were found, and then Hurricane Dorian struck in 2019, making their survival unlikely. Diana Bell wrote in an essay for The Conservation, "In fact, Hurricane Dorian may have not only sealed the fate of the nuthatch, but also severely impacted other birds endemic to these islands, particularly the Bahama warbler and the Abaco parrot," adding, "Also known as the Bahama Amazon parrot, this subspecies uniquely nests in limestone cavities underground, which are likely to have been flooded by the storm surge." The risk to wildlife from extreme storms can be compounded by the ramping effects of climate change too. In other places, extreme weather is an extra blow to species already struggling with other environmental pressures, like habitat loss, invasive species, or pollution. Last year, the world watched in horror as land use management, climate change, and drought helped push Australia's bushfires to a terrifying new level, killing 34 people and burning 37,500 square miles. In the immediate aftermath, one expert put the death toll for wildlife at 1 billion animals lost, Since then, the figure has been revised to 3 billion killed or displaced by the wildfires. A study published in Nature Ecology and Evolution found that the fire impacted the critical habitat of 832 native species, with 70 species losing more than 30% of their natural range. 21 of those were already at risk of extinction. Those that survived could find themselves hard-pressed in future climate disasters. Australia already has one of the highest extinction rates, and the wildfires could limit the capacity of some species to recover in Australia, like the endangered kangaroo island, Donart, and the long-footed potoroo, and threaten others. The study in Nature Ecology and Evolution found Australia's record blazes last year could push the number of endangered species in the country up by 19%. When Hurricane Irma sacked the Florida Keys in 2017, the storm tossed boats ashore and destroyed more than 1,000 homes and left a trail of debris across the islands. It also endangered one of the region's beloved endemic species, the tiny key deer, which today primarily lives on Big Pine Key. Some deer were killed in the storm, and surviving animals face threats to their already limited freshwater supply as the storm surge dumped saline ocean water into the freshwater pools. Island residents responded the way folks often do after a disaster. They offered help to their neighbors. Following Australia's bushfires last year, the country's government jumped to the aid of wildlife by dropping 4,000 pounds of carrots and sweet potatoes to starving brush-tailed rock wallabies who lost the food source in the wildfires. But beyond immediate food and water relief, there's a much bigger task ahead. Reducing greenhouse gas emissions to address the ongoing dangers of climate change and the ability of ecosystems to adapt. For example, Florida Key deer also face a long-term threat to their drinking water supply from rising seas, something no number of kiddie pools can repair. And more severe hurricanes are likely in future as well. Sean Maxwell says, as climate change continues to ensure extreme climate and weather events are more and more common, we now need to act to ensure species have the best chance to survive. Adding, wherever possible, high quality and intact habitat areas should be retained, as these are the places where species are most resilient to increasing exposure to extreme events. His study found if such intact habitats doesn't exist, ecological restoration efforts can be used to help species adapt, and the more we know, the better. The researchers of the 2018 paper concluded, incorporating extreme events into climate change, vulnerability assessments and adaptation plans will be challenging, adding, but by doing so, we have a greater chance of arriving at conservation interventions that truly address the full range of climate change impacts, and that could give more species a fighting chance in a changing climate.
The future of the U.S. military budget hangs in the balance. This as President Joe Biden is following in the footsteps of his predecessor Donald Trump by refusing to cut the 2021 military spending. Officials have reported that Biden is postponing a reset of priorities as part of the Pentagon's expenditure, which is due on May 3rd. The budget will come in at just over $696 billion. That means the national security budgets, including the Department of Energy's outlay, could total more than $735 billion. The figure is comparable to the base funding provided to the Pentagon in 2021. Biden's decision is likely to draw criticism from his own so-called progressive supporters. But a major reduction in the budget is highly unlikely. That's because Democratic majorities in the House and Senate are slim, and not all Democrats agree to cutting military budgets significantly. That's according to Center for Strategic and International Studies paper. On the other hand, Joe Biden, like his predecessor, seems to have caved in to the military and defense contractors. Hence, no drawdown in the number of U.S. bases or troops overseas.
Those of us in the peace movement are very concerned about this because, on the one hand, he talked during his campaign and continues to talk about wanting to end these endless wars. And yet, if he's not going to bring troops out of Iraq or Afghanistan, how is he going to end the wars? We're also concerned about the airstrikes that have been going on because he has continued the policy of Donald Trump, which is not to publish any of the statistics about U.S. airstrikes. So it's not just the troops, it's the bombing that we want to stop.
American arms companies spend millions of dollars every year lobbying politicians and donating to their campaigns. According to figures by OpenSecret.org, top contributors to federal candidates, parties, and outside groups include Lockheed Martin, Raytheon Technologies, and Northrop Grumman, with each contributing more than $5 million. The total contribution makes up to $45 million, which has a direct impact on U.S. war decisions and troop deployments abroad. The USA Today has revealed Washington's so-called war on terror has affected 85 countries in the last 3 years alone. The newspaper also says over 19 years after the September 11 attacks, America is still entangled in conflict in West Asia and beyond, and there is still no end in sight to the unpopular wars.
It seems like no president wants to upset the status quo of the continued war machine. They don't want to go up against the weapons industry. They don't want to go against the hawks in Congress. And they don't want to be responsible for, quote, losing a war. But the U.S. has lost these wars a long time ago. And the only thing we're doing now is expending precious resources and lives in a continued failed effort.
But why does the U.S. insist on continuing these wars in spite of the fact that they have proven to be futile?
Well, in the case of Afghanistan, it's pretty clear that the Taliban control most of the country now. And if the U.S. leaves, because the government that the U.S. has been supporting for almost 20 years is very corrupt and doesn't have a large base of support, and the military that the U.S. has been training for almost 20 years is not capable of fighting the Taliban, the Taliban will have even more power once the U.S. leaves, and no U.S. president wants to be responsible for that. In the case of Iraq, it's quite similar. The U.S. is supporting governments that can't stand up on their own. And so if the U.S. leaves, these governments will probably be overtaken by other groups, and nobody in the White House wants to be responsible for that.
Apart from the suffering the conflict inflicted on target nations, the U.S. itself paid dearly for its wars. America has spent a whopping $7 trillion in taxpayers' money on the wars after the 9/11 attacks of 2001. That's not just about treasure, but blood. The U.S. has lost more than 4,500 soldiers in Iraq since 2003. The number of U.S. troops killed in Afghanistan as of 2001 stands at nearly 2,500. Those tallies are based on official figures. Some observers say the real death toll might be way higher. But there are no signs that the U.S. will free itself from the vortex it created in the first place anytime soon.
The U.S. airstrike against the positions of anti-terror resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border last month has opened a debate on the presidential war powers, drawing criticism from several American lawmakers who argue that President Joe Biden must have consulted the Congress before authorizing the raids.
But as Tulsi Gabbard, former U.S. Congresswoman from Hawaii, has pointed out, the bigger picture is being missed by many.
The regime change war the United States continues to wage in Syria, using al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, HTS terrorists as our proxy ground force, and who now occupy and control the city of Idlib.
Gabbard also drew a parallel between the crippling U.S. sanctions on Syria and the U.S.-Saudi sanctions on Yemen, saying the embargo is threatening the lives of millions of Syrians and preventing the war-torn country from reconstruction.
In terms of the attacks on Tulsi Gabbard, in my view, she's been attacked because she's anti-war, because she has been honest about U.S. foreign policy. She's been honest about the fact that the U.S. has been supporting groups like al-Qaeda and ISIS. She has called for the end of the U.S. forever wars in the Middle East. And that's the third rail of American politics. That's something that both parties agree on, that those wars should continue. And that's why she's attacked.
Since ordering the air raids on Syria, President Biden has also been criticized for keeping up America's interventionist policy in Syria and following in the footsteps of his hawkish predecessor, former President Donald Trump, who publicly bragged that the U.S. military was deployed in Syria to take the Arab country's oil.
And then they say he left troops in Syria. You know what I did? I left troops to take the oil. I took the oil. The only troops I have are taking the oil.
Biden's ordering the attack less than 2 months into his presidency has raised the question, is the U.S. West Asia policy ever going to change? The U.S. and its allies' support for terrorists in West Asia is no news, as many current and former American officials have acknowledged who has been behind a multitude of crises in the region. In a speech at the Institute of Politics at the Harvard University in 2014, then-Vice President Joe Biden painted a clear picture of what had been happening in Syria behind the scenes.
Our allies in the region were our largest problem in Syria. The Turks were great friends, and I have a great relationship with Erdogan, which I just spent a lot of time with. The Saudis, the Emiratis, etc. What were they doing? They were so determined to take down Assad and essentially have a proxy Sunni-Shia war. What did they do? They poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens, thousands of tons of weapons into anyone who would fight against Assad. Except that the people who were being supplied were al-Nusra and al-Qaeda and the extremist elements of jihadis coming from other parts of the world.
Well, I think Biden ultimately would like regime change in Syria, though I think that he understands that that's probably a remote chance. I think that the U.S. will settle for the Balkanization of Syria.
In addition, Donald Trump alleged in numerous instances during the 2016 presidential campaign that then-President Barack Obama and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton founded the Daesh terror group.
ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS. Okay? He's the founder. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton.
But not only none of those speeches resulted in any de-escalation in Syria, the U.S. exacerbated the situation further by pressing ahead with its anti-Damascus policies. One of the recent instances of which was Donald Trump signing into law the CSAR Act in 2020, which imposed a set of draconian economic sanctions on Syria. The conflict in Syria has left a trail of death and destruction in its wake. The West's sanctions and attacks conducted by Israel on the U.S. are hindering any attempts to rebuild the Arab nation.
The head of the Roman Catholic Church, Pope Francis, arrived at Baghdad International Airport on a historic visit to Iraq on Friday. Security was beefed up in Iraqi cities to welcome the Catholic leader on his first international trip since the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. The 84-year-old Pope called his first ever visit to Iraq the Pilgrim of Peace saying that he was duty-bound to visit the country amid COVID-19 and security concerns. However, Iraqi officials were well prepared to welcome the pontiff as they beefed up security and imposed a nationwide curfew prior to his visit. Upon arrival, the Pope was welcomed by the Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi in Baghdad Airport. Then he met with Iraqi President Barham Saleh at the Presidential Palace. Pope Francis called for an end to acts of extremism and intolerance and said that Iraqis of all religions deserve to have the same rights.
Over the past several decades, Iraq has suffered the disastrous effects of wars, the scourge of terrorism, and sectarian conflicts often grounded in a fundamentalism incapable of accepting the peaceful coexistence of different ethnic and religious groups, different ideas and cultures. All this has brought in its wake death, destruction and ruin.
Pope Francis entered the holy city of Najaf to hold a historic meeting with Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, on Saturday. That marked the first time that a pope has met with such a senior Shia cleric. During the meeting, Ayatollah Sistani affirmed his concern that Iraqi Christians should live like all other Iraqis in peace and security and with their full constitutional rights. He underlined the importance of concerted efforts to prepare the ground for coexistence between all people based on mutual respect. Ayatollah Sistani also said many regional countries, including Palestine, are suffering from injustice, war, and blockade. He said the religious leaders have to encourage the involved parties to conflicts, particularly the world powers, to prioritize rationality instead of confrontation. He noted that the leaders have to urge these parties to avoid expansionism and personal interests. That is why Pope Francis thanked Ayatollah Sistani for raising his voice in defense of the weakest and most persecuted during some of the most violent moments in Iraq's contemporary history. The Pope's visit to Ur was another highlight of his trip. The city is where the prophet Abraham, a key figure in the Christian faith, is believed to have been born. Later, the Pope addressed the faithful at the Our Lady of Salvation Church in Baghdad's commercial Qurrata district, where back in 2010, Daesh terrorists stormed the church and killed 44 worshippers, two priests, and several security force personnel in one of the deadliest attacks on Iraq's Christians.
So, the Pope is a man of peace, and there is a great potentiality for peace. A great potentiality that his visit in cooperation with Ayatollah Sistani, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, might actually contribute to defeating extremism.
After the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center twin buildings in 2001, the U.S. declared a global war on terror. That gave Washington an excuse to enter the West Asia region, beginning with Afghanistan. 2 years later, the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003 and opened a second major front in its so-called war on terror. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence. In 2014, the country was overrun by the Daesh terror group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion. Interestingly, during the 2016 presidential campaigns, former U.S. President Donald Trump said that Obama and Clinton are co-founders of the Daesh terrorist group. The terrorist group was vanquished in December 2017 after a three-year anti-terror military campaign with the crucial support of Iran. The top Iranian commander, General Qasem Soleimani, and Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit's commander, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, were key in eliminating Daesh terrorists.
And we must not underrate those. But here again, we have a great, if you like, emotional, positive emotional image of the leader of Catholic Christianity, Pope Francis, and the leader of chief figure of Shia Islam in Iraq, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, coming together, expressing what they have in common and being, in a way, friends and affirming a message of which is common to most religions. So I would say that is a very strong emotional and passionate.
The U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, as well as wars and repression by Daesh terrorists, devastated Iraq's minority Christian community. The instability and persistent chaos resulted in a drop in the number of Christians from nearly 1.4 million to about 250,000 today. In a speech during his visit, the Pope called Iraq the cradle of civilization. He noted that the country has suffered the disastrous effects of the so-called war on terrorism. Isn't it high time for the West, especially the U.S., to stop its intervention in Iraq and put an end to its disastrous presence there?
The United States remains on a collision course with the International Criminal Court, even after the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump yielded power to the Joe Biden administration, which was expected to be softer on issues related to international organizations. The reasons for the troubled relations have remained unchanged: the ICC's decision to probe war crimes committed by the United States and Israel. ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda, who has been probing war crimes committed by Israel, the U.S., and their allies, said in December 2019 that such crimes have been or were committed in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. She named the Israeli military, which has for years unleashed a reign of terror on Palestinians, as the perpetrator of war crimes. The ICC prosecutor further noted that there was a reasonable basis to launch a probe into Israeli military actions in the besieged Gaza Strip, as well as illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. Bensouda then asked judges to rule on the extent of the court's jurisdiction in the case, and the court last month established that it had jurisdiction. The announcement was not received well by Washington and Tel Aviv. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a phone call that the U.S. opposes any such probe, as the court has no jurisdiction over the matter. The phone call followed U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken's statement that Washington firmly opposes and is deeply disappointed by the decision.
And if the state is very certain and very secure that the Israeli regime and these occupiers have not committed war crimes, so why not give a chance to the investigators, the bipartisan group that will be coming in, that is not biased? And they will be investigating all the cases that they have in their files, in their system, and to prove that they're innocent, right? And then at that point, we don't have this continuous problem coming up and arising again.
The U.S. and Israel have repeatedly shown their opposition to being held accountable for their actions over the years. The ICC, which has often sought to expose war crimes committed by the Israeli regime and the U.S. around the world, has faced bullying and intimidation from both Tel Aviv and Washington. The Trump administration imposed sanctions on the Hague-based tribunal staff last year, targeting them with asset freezes and travel bans, accusing them of violating the U.S. national sovereignty by launching a probe into war crimes committed by the U.S. troops in Afghanistan. The Biden administration took no immediate action to reverse the move, despite promising to put overruling Trump's damaging measures on top of his agenda. The new U.S. administration did announce it would rejoin the United Nations Human Rights Council, which its predecessor withdrew from 2018, citing an anti-Israeli bias, but it said upon re-engaging with the U.N. body, it will press to eliminate a disproportionate focus on its Israeli ally.
I mean, this shows essentially from the beginning that they're not going there really for human rights. They're going there to secure and support Israel and to bury their war crimes and to get people away from holding the Israeli regime accountable. I mean, why is there all these resolutions in the first place against Israel? Obviously because there's continuous developments, there's continuous war crimes, there's continuous bombardments, there's continuous blockades, there's continuous crimes.
We will be back. And I'm a man of my word. America is back. I speak today as President of the United States at the very start of my administration, and I'm sending a clear message to the world. America is back.
Joe Biden has repeated this sentence multiple times since becoming president, taking a veiled sideswipe at his predecessor's isolation foreign policy and promising a return to multilateralism in a bid to win over the estranged U.S. allies and revive the frosty transatlantic relations. While Washington's European partners have largely expressed support for his administration, divisions between them still persist. In the latest example, an EU spokesperson said, "The bloc supports the ICC as an independent and impartial judicial institution with no political objectives to pursue." Peter Stano was responding to a request for comment on Netanyahu's recent diatribe against the court, who had blasted the war crime probe as, quote, the essence of anti-Semitism. President Biden says he will bring back what he calls America's moral leadership in the world. The question is, how can the U.S. advocate such leadership while it continues to penalize those who work to expose crimes instead of the true culprits?
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters all around the globe, welcome to IRIB English Radio and the program For Humanity. You can reach us at our email address, englishradio@irib.ir. We were discussing one of the rights of the book, The Treatise of Rights, Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad Ali ibn al-Husayn Zainul Abidin alayhim wassalam. In right number 39, the name of that right is the right of him who seeks your advice. He says in that right, and the right of him who seeks your advice is that you should exert all